This is MIA Podcast Discussion, Gaddafi's Downfall and Its Impact on Sub-Saharan Africa, was recorded during the 5th Annual Conference of the Association for the Study of the Middle East and Africa in Washington, D.C. on October 12, 2012.
Thank you very much. Okay, so we start with the heart of the matter. You know, Gaddafi was the longest serving president in Africa. And at the end, he even termed himself the King of Kings of Africa. I had the privilege of witnessing that in Addis Ababa. It was a rather bizarre performance. In a way, people were used to his persona, which was so ludicrous and so incredible, that the reality behind his regime, or what Libya had become, slowly sort of faded into the background. And one thing, it was seen as a purely Arab country, when it is largely, of course, especially if you look at the fact that about 90% of the population is on a very thin strip of less than 20 kilometers along the coast. But what about the 4% that live in there? That is far from being purely Arab. This is something which is totally obscured, although he himself was keenly aware of it, and he really always relied, especially for his security, on having special troops, which is a nice word for mercenaries, either coming from the Tuareg or from even the black minorities. Oops, does it work? Yeah, the Toubou. Who are the people who are astride the border with Chad. And on the contrary, he strongly always had problems with the Berber groups that are in Jebel Nafusa and the northwestern part close to the Tunisia border. And one thing that was not noticed is that, throughout the period, and of course this is a summary that was given by The Economist during the period of the struggle in Libya, this is a little short, because there you have the impression that the Tuareg rebellions began only in the 1990s. Not so. They started in the 1960s after the French refused the creation of a Tuareg state. And actually this is a very interesting parallel for people who are interested in the Middle East, with the Kurds. Because the problem of the Tuareg is that they're all over the place. They're here, of course, but they're also here in Mauritania, in the southeastern part. They're here in Niger. They're all over southern Algeria. And, of course, they are in southwestern Libya. And their demands to the French government in 1959-60, when de Gaulle was negotiating the future of the French colonies in the region, was for a Tuareg state. And everybody refused. Modibo Keïta in Mali, later he was faced with the Tuareg insurrection. Later, Seyni Kounché had the same problem in Niger. It's exactly like the Kurds. These people suffered from being separated among a variety of nation states, or perhaps states that were not nations, never being given the opportunity of doing what they wanted. And Gaddafi, of course, this is what is alluded to here, picked that up in a type of attitude which was so typical of the man. At times, I have a friend who wrote a book called Gaddafi's Africa's Policy. I asked him how he could write that, because it's like, history of the whirlwind. Things were changing all the time, new institutions, new policies, new directions. There was one coherent thing. I want to be big. I have a small country, but I have a lot of money. And therefore, I'm trying to push myself in the forefront of policies and events, by all means. And at times, supporting an insurrection, and then supporting the government that was repressing the insurrection, and then negotiating the peace, You know, which is the, you know, that way you appear at all the various ends of the process, and somehow you make yourself unavoidable and necessary. The problem, of course, is that for the people who are involved in these processes, they did not take it lightly. For him, it was a game. For them, it was their lives. So there is a continuity in the history of the Tuareg rebel movement, which, of course, goes beyond Gaddafi, although he fed into it constantly. The problem was that he fed into it up to the very end. That is, in February 2011, when things started to go wrong for him, he had recourse to his traditional policies. He started hiring mercenaries, and among those mercenaries were a lot of Tuareg. And of course, some were Tuareg who came from here in Libya itself. But he also hired a lot of foreigners. Of course, this means nothing. All these borders, you know, especially, you know, As-Sahara, it's a great expanse of land where borders are highly theoretical. And for the Berbers, for the Tuareg who came to fight for him, their passport, the place where they were born, were completely irrelevant. The problem is that these people, later, when he died in October, finally went back and they went home. And another problem, which of course had consequences for the whole area, was the over-equipment of the Libyan army. The Libyan army had enough weapons to equip probably a population larger than the whole population of Libya, men, women, and children included. There were huge depots of weapons. And strangely enough, since he was afraid of his own army, which is another of the paradoxes of the man, he did not give the weapons to his army, because the army might be tempted to use the weapons against him. So the weapons, apart from special units, especially the ones that were commanded by his own sons, would be stashed in various depots. And a lot of these depots were in the south. Okay, you see Kufra, yeah. And all over this area, you had perhaps from 60 to 70% of the army of the weapons resources of the Libyan army. And they were in nobody's hands, and they did not even have guards. Or they had a few guards, and when things started to go bad, the guards simply evaporated. They disappeared. I talked with Sudanese rebels, because there were all kinds of people who were supporting him to the bitter end, and some of those were people of the justice and equality movement of Khalid Ibrahim, who got killed a little bit later after he fled from Sirte. And I talked with some of these guys who went back all the way from Sirte, all the way. They started there, and they ended up here. And they took with them about 200 trucks of weaponry. Only 200 because they didn't have more trucks. They could have taken 400, 500. They said, we left lots of good things, you know, and but we couldn't take everything. They selected the type of weapons. They said, for example, we wouldn't take 155-millimeter artillery, because what would we do with that? But they had all the mortars, all the machine guns, all the RPGs that they could dream of. Except that was not very good for their guerrilla. And this is one reason why I'm not going to talk about that except this brief mention. They didn't find fuel, they didn't find enough ammunition, and they didn't find medicines. So for the guerrilla, they have tons of weapons, which are still there in Darfur, but they can't use them. Because a guerrilla is not only weapons, it's all the things that go around. But not so with the people who took another route and went down like this and like this. And even some of them who are still in southern Algeria, which is a big headache for the Algerian government. So this is where it came from, so to speak. Now, what do we have at the other end, the receiving end? The Tuareg guerrilla movement or liberation movement or national movement, I mean, we can use many words, really started just about the time of his death in its present form. It doesn't mean that there were not other organizations before, but they were all ad hoc. Now, the first one was the MNLA, the Mouvement National de Libération de la Zawad. I'm sorry, I'm going to use French for the. I'm used to these acronyms in French. Anyway, a lot of these guys are French speakers. You can reestablish the English acronyms, which was created, the birthday is coming soon, on October 16th, 2011. And these guys were largely, I would say, secular. In a way, they were very influenced by the Algerian FNL, FLN, sorry. They were really nationalists. But given the spirit of the times, the zeitgeist, it was bound to have an Islamic declension. And this was the work of a strange person who is now the most important person in North Mali, which is Iyad Akhali. He's a former contrebandier, a smuggler of cigarettes. He's also a man who made a lot of money by capturing hostages. All these various movements, we'll talk about ACMI in a minute, but are really making tens of millions of dollars, and now I could say hundreds of millions of dollars out of hostages. There have been about, in the last 5-6 years, 200 cases of hostage taking. And the prices are going up. I was recently in Bamako, and the French hostages that were captured in Arlit in 2011, there are 6 guys now, they're worth 90, at least, that is what's being asked, 90 million euros for 6 people. The prices keep going up and up and up. The MNLA was the first branch, but Iyad Akhali created Ansar ad-Din, which is a kind of offshoot of the Tuareg movement, but with a definitely Islamist agenda. And strangely enough, there are two Islamist groups, because there is another one, which is called Mujao, which is Mouvement pour l'Unité et le Jihad dans l'Afrique Occidentale. And now they have various, MNLA, started occupying all the north, but then they got kicked out by Ansar ad-Din from Timbuktu, and then they got kicked out from Gao, which is here, by the Mujao. Why this difference? Because you find that Islam, in its radical form, is like communism was 40 years ago. This is a label. You scratch a little bit under the label, you find something else under. And Mujao has a special agenda which has nothing to do with Islam, which is, really, we don't like the Algerians. It's very amusing because it was born here, in Tindouf, which is just the southwestern part of the Algerian desert. And really, basically, there are people who have really a beef with the Algerian government. So they keep picking Algerian hostages, which are not really the best. You don't get much money for these guys. It's much better to pick a European, he's worth more money. Also, they put bombs in Algeria, which of course doesn't make them very popular. The Algerians are really, really not very happy with them. But this is their advocation in life, which has very little to do with Islam, but a lot to do with the local politics. And then you have the joker in the pack of cards, which is not a Tuareg movement, which is ACMI, Al-Qaeda or Maghreb Islamique. And that is an organization which has a long history because it goes back to the Algerian Civil War of the 90s. Actually, it started with the Groupe Islamique Armé, which was one of the protagonists of the Algerian civil war on the Islamist side. These are basically the losers. the guys who had to go into the Sahara because they had to avoid being on the coast in too populated areas where they did not have sufficient support. And then it moved into something that was called Groupe Salafiste de Prédication et de Combat in 1998. And the GSPC had an area here. You know, it started purely as Algerian. Huh? And actually, a lot of the key people in ACMI are Algerians still today. But their ninth sector, you know, they go Katiba by Katiba in the old FLN style. They extends like this. So it was trans-border between southwestern Algeria, northeastern Mauritania, and northern Mali. But they were not Tuareg. They were Arabs. Huh? So this, but they had a few Tuareg amongst them. And interesting enough, as head of the Katiba, or vice head of the Katiba, was a cousin of Aghrali. So that means that there was a kind of projection, if you will, there was a hook linking the Tuareg rebellion with some a minority, within the GSPC. And the GSPC is today ACMI. I mean, the ninth section of the GSPC is ACMI. And so they moved in a big way into kidnapping and to make things more complicated. You see, here you have Guinea, okay? Here you have, you cannot see, it's just outside of the map, Guinea-Bissau. Guinea-Bissau has become the first fully drug-controlled state in Africa. The president, the vice president, everybody's a drug dealer. The previous president was murdered by the vice president, who was then murdered by, I think, the chief of staff of the army. They all shot each other in the president's office. It was very family-like. And these guys are Portuguese speakers, and they are linked with the outlet of some, you know, going as far north as the Sinaloa cartel in Mexico, a Brazilian offshoot of the South American drug cartels. And they ship there, and also a Venezuelan branch, which is not very well known. That is a bit peculiar, you know, but that doesn't matter because you can talk about Portugal, you know, as they did during the years of the civil war in Angola. When the Cubans were there, everybody said they speak Portugal, you know, which is Portuguese and Espanol mixed. But anyway, the drug doesn't have any flag, doesn't have any nationality. And it comes to Guinea-Bissau, which is a drug state completely. The army is controlled by the drug lords, the government, up to the president, they're all, you know, completely. And then they need some kind of an outlet. And this outlet has been going through the Sahara. You know, the drug originates here. And then it goes like this, and some of it went to Libya, but most of it, rather, went to Tunisia and Algeria. And it irrigates the drug market in Italy and France and Spain. And there is a lot of money to be made. This is an interesting situation there, because it goes back to the 1980s with the Maitatsine movement. People who like Nigeria probably remember that. There was a kind of hole after this movement was crushed. And then it reappeared a few years ago under its modern name of Boko Haram. The leader of this movement was summarily dealt with because the Nigerian army is rather full of resolution. Last week they just killed another 40 people because one of their own was killed by a Boko Haram targeted attack. Probably, in my impression from what happened, is that the 40 people they killed had nothing to do with Boko Haram. They just went and just killed a bunch of Muslims, because especially the Christian soldiers are apt to do that. That, of course, is not very good, because that's a great recruitment system for Boko Haram. But these guys, since their life has been a little bit difficult, started to spread out and go especially into Niger. So since the Tuareg movement has moved into Western Niger, which is Tuareg populated, and since it has radicalized itself with these new things like Ansar eddin and Mujao, there is now contacts. The guys from Boko Haram, who were not military people at all, went and got some training in Somalia, of all places. They crossed over and they were with the Shebab for a while, before the Shebab became a little bit undone in the last Amisom events of the last 7-8 months. So they have a minimum of military training, although it is not at all like the Tuareg, who through their connections in Algeria and with the Libyans have a nucleus of very seriously trained people. Since perhaps now, I have to say, because, you know, this is still the prologue to the introduction to the first chapter. We'll skip a lot of other aspects, but let's concentrate on Mali. Mali really took a full blow of what was happening, let's say in after October 2011. By January of this year, with all the Tuareg coming down from Libya, you know, all equipped, you know, if my friends in GEM could have 200 trucks, when they were really foreigners, they came all the way from Sudan. You can imagine what the Tuareg, who knew everybody, had, you know, their ins and outs, and, you know, they took a lot. And of course, they had more equipment, more men, more everything than the Malian army. It was not at all a kind of subversive guerrilla. You know, the guerrilla are supposed to be, you need normally 8 to 10 regular troops to for every single guerrilla fighter in an insurrectionist movement. There were more fighters among the insurgents, and they had more equipment than the regular army. So that was not very good for the Malian army. They lost a lot of men here in a place called Egilhok in the north. That was very brutal. Of course, there is a whole racial dimension. Huh? This is a strange insurrection. It's a white insurrection against a black government. And except these are the people who are not Arabs. They are the people, you know, if you look at the Roman text, they are the people the Romans were calling Numids. You know, if you read the War of Jugurtha, you know, these are the people who were there a long time before the Arabs. Whether you talk about the Berbers or the Tuareg, who are quite different, they don't speak the same language and so on, but both of them are among those various populations that existed in northern Africa 1,000 years, 2,000 years before the arrival of the Arabs. And of course, the government, you know, if you look at the population dynamics, you know, the black people who live here in the south, I mean, they stop here around Mopti, are 5, 6 times, 10 times more numerous than, I mean, people don't exactly know how many Tuareg they are, especially as they don't respect border and they come from other countries and so on. But in one thing is sure, the black population is much more numerous. And the government is completely under them. There is once in a while one Tuareg minister who is usually there for the decoration. This was a situation where the POWs that were taken in the north were slaughtered. The Tuareg killed them all. They just slit their throats. It was over 200 people killed in cold blood. So the army exploded in Bamako. It was the women. You know, the wives, the sisters, daughters, they practically told the soldiers, remove that stupid garment of ours, we can't have this. And this is exactly what a little officer, totally unknown, Captain Sanogo, did one fine morning. He said, okay, end of the story, Amani Touré, you're gone. You know, the president this was a rather rotten government, quite corrupt and so on. And even among the black African population, there was very little enthusiasm for the regime. So when the coup occurred, the coup had a huge support. You know, we always think, you know, democracy is good and so on. But when democracy lands with a very bad democratic government, the coup was, you know, enthusiastically supported by the population, which was very embarrassing for ECOWAS, the original organization, which of course condemned the coup, condemned everything. You know, they didn't know. So they condemned the Tuareg, they condemned the massacres, they condemned the coup. But then what to do? It was not very clear. Condemnation is easy, advice is more difficult. But Sanogo ended up in charge, and he's a little captain who is, you know, he knows how to read and write, but not much more. Suddenly he found himself the boss of that country. It didn't last very long. Soon he sort of admitted that there should be a civilian government, Diakoundé Traoré, but the civilian government was totally impotent. Actually, they invaded the president's office and beat the hell out of him one fine morning. He spent 6-7 weeks in France recuperating from the beating he got from the army people. It was not the army themselves. It was their supporters, civilian supporters of the army, invaded the civilian president's office to beat him up because he pretended that he was going to take over from the military. So the situation now is incredibly, you know, when you're polite, you say complex. When you're not polite, you say a bloody mess. When you're there, you don't know who is the government. You have ministers who tell you themselves when you speak to them, I have no power. If you know, you can go to the minister's office, he will willingly tell you, no, I'm a minister in theory, but I have no power. You have an army which is not very united because Captain Sanogo is not a charismatic leader. And for example, recently, ECOWAS met, that was about 5 weeks ago, and they said, we're going to intervene. This is too much, we cannot have this. They had 3,300 men that they wanted to put for their intervention force. Now, you take 3,300 men, you put them in there, they disappear, they dissolve. In the sand. When you think of what World War II was in the same terrain, because it was fought, you know, in this terrain, you know, here, on the border between Egypt and Libya, I mean, 200,000-300,000 men were required for anything serious. 3,300 men trying to operate in such an environment, especially with the Tuareg fighters, who are extremely good, who know the terrain perfectly, who are extremely well armed, it's not a very attractive proposition. So Sanogo, who felt lost, said, okay, all right, you can do it. Immediately, some of the officers said, you get those bastards in here, we have a coup. We take you out and we take them out. He said, no, we are going to take care of that. And now the situation is a kind of dead end because that very small army, poorly equipped, of course, everybody's begging the French. You know, hey, we have a mutual defense agreements, blah, blah, and so on. I mean, this is what the Congo, and that is what is being discussed right now, what was being discussed at the Francophonie Summit in Kinshasa. You know, all the agenda of the Kinshasa meeting went out of the window. And there were two things, the legitimacy of Kabila and what is happening in Mali. Because among the Francophone African countries, these are the only things to be discussed right now. And President François Hollande is not at all enthusiastic about Africa. He does not want to intervene. And he's in disagreement with his Minister of Foreign Affairs, Mr. Fabius, who thinks this is, the equivalent of Afghanistan right on our doorstep. So now the French are arguing among themselves. The probability is they're not going to do much. They would like to support ECOWAS. Supporting ECOWAS is a non-starter. But of course, it's a way of hiding behind your little finger. You say, you guys do it for us. You know, African solution for African problems. You know, I hate that slogan because it's a slogan of cowardice, you know. Saying, you guys, you die, it's okay, but we will look at it from a distance and provide you with the necessary weapons. This, I think, we're going to have another bout of that. Now, the Americans have a few troops on the ground, about 60 of them. 30 here and 30 here in the north of Burkina Faso. And you have two small Cessna aircraft. They're very cute. I saw them flying. It shows also that the likelihood that those man pads, you know, those shoulder-fired anti-aircraft missiles, that supposedly 10,000 of them were stolen from the Gaddafi arsenal. Obviously, they're not in Mali because I saw the little thing going put-put-put at 80 miles an hour. and nobody shut them down. And they're supposed to have electronics on board. I don't know how much electronics you can put in a Cessna 172, but so this is the state of American intervention so far. And that poses a very big question. What is Djibouti? You say, hey, where is Djibouti? Well, Djibouti is the only American base on the continent, and these guys come from there.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast. To become an ASMIA member or to learn more about ASMIA, please visit us online at asmiascholars.org. That's ASMEA scholars.org.